better be watching. You better be watching in the dark. You better be watching.
Mr. Pearson invited me into the house, and I thought for a second, knowing what I know now, I could have been the fourth bag under the house.
I was the main witness. I had to tell them about everything that I found, and that I felt that they were under the house. And stared at me, stared me down, and I just looked right back at them.
I'm Sonia Paz.
And I'm Mara Kospczyk.
And we are your host of Investigated.
This podcast describes scenes of true crime details and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please be advised.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to episode 2 of Investigated. And I am so excited again to welcoming my amazing host, Mark Kopczyk. How are you doing today, Mark?
I'm good. How are you today, Sonia?
Pretty good. Pretty excited about delving into part 2.
Absolutely.
And we've got a lot to cover for this episode, a lot of acknowledgments. I want to definitely give a few shout outs for writers that wrote articles that we're going to be reflecting in this episode. And of course, there has been a lot of questions since our first episode, and we have fans now. We have friends and fans. So that's a good thing.
Yay.
Woohoo. Gotta love fans. One of the main questions people were asking me is, who is this guy? Who is James Arthur Pearson? And what's his story? Let's take it from the beginning. Go ahead and tell us a bit about who he is and a bit of a background on James and his family.
A lot of people have been asking us about James Arthur Pearson after our last podcast as far as some detailed information. Well, his name's James Arthur Pearson, born July 18th, 1925. In Pendleton, Oregon. He had a couple of aliases, Albert Fore, F-O-R-E, and George David Watson, and George David Watson III. He was married to Pauline Pearson, who was born September 21st, 1918, in Czechoslovakia. Her maiden name was Rodvam. They were married November 11th, 1947, in Pendleton, Oregon, and had two daughters, Paula, 18, and Marianne, 14, both ages at the time of their death. Paula went to Cupertino High School and graduated in 1969, and Marianne was a freshman there at the same high school. James had this family, and you'll come to find out that he had two additional families as well, and those we'll cover in future episodes, and it'll become much more evident to you about who he actually was in his lifetime.
Because we will learn a lot about who he was and who he wasn't. In the mountains and mountains of research of what I have completed and what I have reached out for Mark to help me with, along with my criminologist, Clark Williams, there is a lot of research and writings of articles and documentation that has been completed. Information that has been uncovered, who is Pearson and why this whole thing even happened and what led up to this point of him killing his family. And these articles were written by seasoned journalists and reporters. Some have been noted, some we just don't know who they were, but I definitely want to be giving a shout out to Kathy Calvert on this article that we're going to talk about today. She actually paired up with Kermit Jadeker, who was a fiction writer and a comic book writer and has been notorious in all different types of writing, co-writing, novels, and other books and things like that. Kathy Calvert was a journalist and writer and very well known in the Northern California Bay Area and beyond for her writings and covering of stories. She unfortunately passed away in 2010 at the age of 75, but she wrote for the Mercury News for over 25 years, and she had covered the Pearson case from approximately 1978 through 1991. And from the looks of it, the article was a collaboration between the two of them who paired together, which is genius, and it was just really amazing. And I'm just saying it was an honor for probably both of them to have worked together on this project. The title of the article is called House with a Secret, and it was written October 6, 1974. The house where horror lay beneath the floor, a secret never suspected, was at 62 Claremont Avenue in Santa Clara, approximately 45 miles south of San Francisco. What happened there was this sort of thing mystery fiction fans generally associate with tall, decaying Victorian mansions, almost lost in a tree shadow. The reality is sharply different. The house in Santa Clara was one of those modern, low-slung homes popular in California and faces to a cherry tree suburban street with lots of sunshine and kids playing. Before the horror came to it and afterwards, the house had a number of tenants. Among them was James Arthur Pearson, a 44-year-old credit manager who looked remarkably like Henry Kissinger.
So, Sonia, the interesting thing about the article mentioning that he looked like Henry Kissinger is actually true because we have that FBI photo of him. And those of you who didn't know Henry Kissinger, he was an American diplomat, political scientist, and geopolitical consultant who served as the Secretary of State and National Security Advisor for the Nixon and Ford era. So that would have been between 1969 and 1977.
Yes, correct. There was a striking resemblance that I do clearly remember. Otherwise, the 6-foot, wavy-haired Pearson was, or seemed to be, the middle-class status, hungry American. He had a wife and 2 daughters, a swimming pool, and in the struggle to appear to be more well-to-do than he really was. He drove a Cadillac, although not a new model, and he had joined a posh country club whose dues were well over his head. Not what you would expect from a man specializing in debt collection. At first meeting, people generally were impressed by Pearson's charm, warmth, and persuasiveness. But one neighbor recalls that Pearson had a nasty temper and cites as proof as his tendency on the golf course, which was to nearly break several golf clubs in anger after playing so poorly. Pearson apparently managed to control his irascibility during working hours. He had started working for a credit bureau in 1960 in his hometown of Pendleton, Oregon, and had been steadily promoted, finally winding up in 67 as a collection manager of the bureau's office in San Jose, California, at a salary of $1,050 per month plus commissions. It was then that he and his family moved to Santa Clara. They stayed at one place a while and then moved to Claremont Avenue. The rent was $175 per month. Pearson's wife, Pauline, was an amiable woman, 7 years his senior, who shared his enthusiasm for golf, as so did their pretty daughters, Paula and Marianne. The whole family had memberships at the exclusive Saratoga Country Club. Paula was exceptionally good at the game and won many tournament trophies. Speaking of Paula, by 1969, Paula was 18 years old and in her final year at Cupertino High School. She edited the school newspaper, belonged to the prestigious California Scholarship Federation, and a year before that had been sent to Holland as a foreign exchange student. Paula is a serious girl, and her sister, who was 14, was always the one laughing in the crowd. Pearson was described as a strict, prohibitive father who taught his family to put on airs about being wealthy. According to a classmate of the older daughter, Paula, Paula always talked about her father having a lot of money, but it all seemed like just a big show. The Cadillac was an older model, and Paula, well, she just dressed like the rest of us. Paula was accepted as a student at the University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Santa Clara, but it was clear Pearson did not want her to go to Berkeley. He thought there were, quote, too many hippies there, end quote, according to Peter Chalot, who had attended high school with Paula. At times, when Peter had called on the Pearson home to take Paula to some type of school function, he seemed to have to make a special effort to make it appear to Pearson that his relationship with the girl was only casual because, quote, her father didn't really want her dating. He was very strict in that way, end quote. There was always a lot of tension between Paula and her father, Peter had added. They never seemed to see eye to eye. Adding in another side note here is that I also recently spoke with Marianne's childhood friend, Kevin Tompkins, who was 14 at the time when he knew Marianne. And he had shared with me that his sister was really best friends with Paula. And that's how Kevin got to know Marianne, is through his sister. He had told me that he doesn't recall a lot. However, he was at the trial. He did testify. And his recollection was that they simply just hung out. They were just friends. He would go by the house and visit. He does remember Pearson. He said that he doesn't remember him talking a whole lot, but he did know that he didn't fancy young teenage boys coming by to visit his daughters. He did also remember that the parents were fairly strict, or namely the father was fairly strict and had strong rules. He had also gone by the house on Claremont. It had to have been a day or so after, because Marianne didn't show up to school that next day. And when he had gone over, he spoke with Pearson and he had told him that the mom and sisters had to depart quickly to get out of town because of a family emergency. And I was really happy to have had the opportunity to talk with Kevin Tompkins to learn this story, because he was actually a witness on the stand and had testified against Pearson as well. The bills started piling up. Pearson had reason to be tense. One day, he clearly went embarrassed to a business associate and asked him to arrange a loan in the excess of $2,000. Suddenly, he had broke down and sobbed about the bills he owed, the associate later recalled. He said that his wife was responsible for the overspending, most of it for their daughters. He claimed the daughters used to use the mother as a weapon to get what they wanted. Pearson obtained the loan, which sufficed to cover all of his debts, including past due country club membership dues. But his troubles didn't end there. Not long afterwards, he was fired for alleged misappropriation of funds from the credit bureau. Charges were never filed, but one source said that Pearson had promised certain assets to cover restitution. Mother steps in. His career as a credit company executive was ruined, and his chances of attaining other employment at a similar level were next to null. Paula was reported to have been very upset by these turn of events. Mrs. Pearson, however, rose totally to the occasion by getting a job as a clerk in a nearby children's clothing store. She worked at Kitty World Fashions that was located on Stevens Creek Boulevard. I want to interject a little factoid here is that, me being from Santa Clara and knowing this area very well, I wanted just to mention that the Kitty World store was a huge toy store at the time. This is way before Toys R Us. It was the largest toy store in the area, and it was on the corner of Stevens Creek Boulevard and San Tomas Expressway in San Jose. It was one of those stores that had a second level that had this giant glass window that had these giant stuffed animals that were life size of buffalo and giraffes and tigers and things like that. So when you drove by it, it was pretty much a festive event to drive by there and see all the newest things. It was where you went to go get the newest toys, games, dolls, and that kind of thing. So that store was 1.8 miles away from the Claremont house. So it was a 6-minute drive, a 9-minute bike ride, and roughly just a 43-minute walk away from there. And this is going to be important because we're going to come back to that later. But I just wanted to mention the thing about Kitty World Fashions. It was pretty prestigious to have worked there. The article continues and says, the store manager later recalled that she was very quiet and kept to herself. She was off on Sundays and one day during the week so that she could go and play golf. Pearson went to his dreary round of job hunting. His qualifications as a businessman were excellent, but the past was against him. June came and Paula was graduating with honors from Cupertino High School. She had received scholarship funds to enable her to attend college. However, the college costs went far beyond the tuition, and whether they could make it under the circumstances was highly moot. Then Pearson got a brilliant idea. He invited his aging mother-in-law to visit the family in Santa Clara. She left her home in Pennsylvania with a cheerful demeanor, readiness, and excitement, for such invitations were rare. Detective Sergeant Don Sessions of the Santa Clara Police Department, who subsequently would have had good reason to investigate the affairs of the Pearson family, as he described the mother-in-law as quite senile, and adds that the investigation showed that Pearson brought her out here for the attempt to gain power of attorney of her properties. Charm didn't work. Throughout the summer of 1969, Pearson, apparently hopeful of a tenant control of his mother-in-law's estates and property in Pennsylvania, exerted all of his charm on her. However, in September, he got the bad news and was told that Pauline's mother had given the power of attorney to her son. A whole summer wasted, the Pearson charm disintegrated. He unceremoniously bundled up his mother-in-law into his car and drove her to San Francisco International Airport. And as Don Sessions had put it, he, quote, dumped the old lady there, end quote. The sergeant said Pearson left it to the Pennsylvania relatives to wire funds for her flight home. So I'm going to take a side note here and ask Mark, am I the only one that finds this behavior as completely bizarre?
I don't think so. I think as we go through the timeline of when this happened and him wanting to get the money from his mother-in-law and then that falling through, this could have totally been the straw that broke the camel's back. And what is it? About a week later, he kills these people, right?
Yes, that is correct.
So that behavior, horrible as it may be, obviously, you don't just dump your mother-in-law at the airport without a ticket back to where she came from. He must have been on the edge at that point.
Correct. Well, and let's go back a little bit too, that this is the 60s, and air travel back then is not like it is now. I mean, it was a luxury to travel by plane back then, and it was quite costly. I mean, it was really expensive. So yeah, so he basically felt defeated. He took the mother-in-law, packed her up, and told her he's taking her to the airport, and she had to contact her family in Pennsylvania to wire her money. It's not like it is today where you can instantly Zelle somebody or Venmo money to somebody. They would have had to use something like Western Union, and that could have taken hours or maybe even an entire day at that time, don't you think?
I would think so. And then, you know, what did he tell Pauline and the kids that he was doing?
Gosh, I mean, I've had grandparents, and I could have never imagined my father having to just drop off my grandmother at the airport like that and just leaving her there. That just blows my mind. And it just shows, again, the lack of consideration, and it's proven. You know, the thing, too, is that she was starting to suffer from onset dementia at the time, and she could have been completely confused, and that just breaks my heart to think about that whole scenario, and just dropping her off there is just really unsettling.
And who knows how long she was actually there after he left her at the airport.
So less than a week later, on Monday, September 22nd, the day after her 51st birthday, Pauline Pearson went to work as usual. At midday, she left the store to go have lunch at home. That very afternoon, Pearson phoned the store manager of the children's store, and he said that there had been a death in the wife's family and that she had gone back to Pennsylvania and that he had no idea when they would be returning. The following day, he had called the store to request to pick up Pauline's paycheck and that he also had a friend doing a repair job on his Cadillac. His story was that he was telling people that Mrs. Pearson and the two girls have already flew east because of a tragic accident that happened to claim the lives of several members of Mrs. Pearson's family. He told them that he was going to be joining the family as soon as he received confirmation that they wouldn't be returning back to California. So Pearson emptied the house of its contents, left a half a dozen huge bulging bags in the backyard for trash pickup, and by Friday, he would be gone as well. A strange discovery. One of his neighbors took it upon herself to be inquisitive, looking over all the trash bags to discover a very strange thing. One box held Paula's golf trophies, all of them, and they had been smashed to pieces. The sudden departure of the Pearsons was a source of neighborhood gossip for some time, and there had been no word from them. They became more or less forgotten. A new family moved into the house at Claremont, and then another, and then another, and the flooring over the living room continued to hold a terrible secret. In 1970, a man named William Kendall purchased the house with his family, moved in, lived there, and tread the floor, and had never guessed at all ever what was underfoot. Meanwhile, it was also in 1970, a middle-aged man by the name of Albert D. Four was married to Mrs. Arlene Nielsen Roosh, age 35, a waitress, a divorcee, and the mother of four children. The wedding was held in Cedar City, Utah, a farm and mining community of 8,000 population in the mountains of southern Utah. Switches religion. The new Mrs. Four was a Mormon, and her new husband, who was a Catholic, became Mormon too. "I was born Mormon," Mrs. Four would subsequently say, "but I had to work to try to live up to his standards. He wouldn't think a day without going to church or saying his prayers." In less than a year, the devout Albert Four was an elder of the Mormon Church of Latter-day Saints and eventually was placed in charge of training young members for the priesthood. On a business level, Four had started working in Cedar City in October 1969 as a vacuum cleaner salesman, but he had soon obtained a job managing a local motel, and within a year, the profits jumped from $10,000 to $15,000. The motel owner sold the place in 1971 to Kenneth Olson, who released the operation to Four. Four bought a car. It was a 1964 Cadillac. Four, a real go-getter, teamed up with several other businessmen to form a land and cattle company to invest into property. The partners thought so much of Four that they made him their banker. The delighted Mrs. Four, meantime, presented her husband with a baby boy who was named Albert D. Four, Jr. Pop Pop Four adored this new baby. Mrs. Four had never known such security. She says, "We had a comfortable home and nice furnishings, and Albert was so very thoughtful." A business trip. On December 21st, 1971, Four told his wife that he had to go away on a brief business trip. He added that he would like to take Junior along, who was only 11 months old at the time, to, quote, "to give me a chance to get better acquainted with him," end quote. The doting Mrs. Four said that it would be fine. 5 days passed and Four didn't show up, and Mrs. Four tearfully reported him and the baby missing to the Cedar City Police Department. She said that amongst other things, he had told her he was a widower, he had two daughters who were all killed in accidents. She revealed that her husband's disappearance had left her family destitute. Financially speaking, Four was not kind to his business associates either. Motel owner Olson said that Four had left him owing him $15,000 on a one-year lease, and the partners in the land and cattle company reportedly made the painful discovery that their banker had never deposited their money estimated to have exceeded $50,000. The FBI in Salt Lake City issued an unlawful flight warrant for Four in connection with assertively passing bad checks written in some Cedar City deals. Meantime, Mrs. Four desperately tried to find her missing baby and did a little bit of detective work on her own. Remembering that Four said that he had once been raised in Pendleton, Oregon, she wrote to the Church of Latter-day Saints there and asked if they could help find him. She enclosed a photograph of him. Revealing photo. They showed the photo around and relates that many people had recognized him, but not as Albert Four, but as James Pearson. James Arthur Pearson, to be precise. Mrs. Four succeeded in locating a twin sister of Pearson, and through her, she reached the brother of Pauline Pearson. The brother wrote to Santa Clara Police Department and quoted that Mrs. Forth is saying that her husband had once told her he had a wife, Pauline, and daughters, Marianne and Paula, and that they had died in 1969. The brother knew nothing about these alleged deaths. Mrs. Forth furnished the Santa Clara Police Department with several photographs from her husband's belongings. One photograph showed Pearson, Paula, and Pauline washing the family car at the Santa Clara home, the home that they rented before moving to Claremont Avenue. So I'm going to add in another side note here. I know this photo because my dad took that photo. I'm confident this is the one that my dad took because my dad was a professional photographer. He took pictures of everything and everyone around the neighborhood. And after my parents passed away, my brother and I have gone through hundreds, thousands of photos. And although we haven't gotten all of them, I'm pretty sure I could probably find a copy of this photo somewhere in my folks' belongings. But I will vouch for that photo because I know that it existed because my dad took that picture. The Santa Clara police investigated and checked with neighbors and were told that Pearson had moved in 1969 without a trace. The coroner's office was also notified, but had no information to the death of Pauline and her daughters. They stated that they were unable to locate Pauline or the family, and an officer had wrote to Pauline's brother stating that there was no evidence that had been developed, indicating no foul play has taken place. So, where was Pearson, alias Four? A mystery. Where were Pauline Pearson's and their daughters, Paula and Marianne? Another mystery. Light on the case. In March 1974, one of these mysteries were solved. Kendall, the man who bought the house on Claremont Avenue, decided to move. And the state of California requires that homeowners planning to sell the property conduct a termite inspection. So Kendall had contacted the inspector, Jerry Sand. Now, these homes had no basement, but they did have a crawl space. So the foundation was mounted on beams, placed across pilings of concrete, and poured into the soil at intervals. So the house had a crawl space that roughly cleared about 2 feet. And Jerry Sand began to enter the crawl space through the hatch and with a very powerful flashlight began examining the under part of the home for termites. He navigated to the corner of the house where he had located a bulk plastic bag. He reached for it and opened it, and it contained 3 skeletons. Police were quickly summoned. They found that each body had been first shrouded in clear plastic and then all 3 had been closed together in 1 huge bag. And piled underneath the home in kind of like a pyramid, one on top of the other, dead identified. So mind you all that these are my friends, and this is going to be a little hard for me to read, but I feel that I need to share all these details. And in recently speaking with Pauline Pearson's nephew, John Radvan Jr., he said, "If I'm going to be telling this story, I need to tell the whole story." And so that is what I'm doing. Dental chart comparisons established that the dead were identified as Pauline Pearson, Paula, and Marianne. And this was conducted by Dr. John Hauser of the Santa Clara County Medical Examiner's Office, stated that Mrs. Pearson died from a crushing blow on the back of the head delivered with a blunt instrument. Marianne's skull was similarly shattered. No such injury was found on Paula's head, and the cause of her death was officially described as undetermined, but she might have been strangled or stabbed, which would not have been disclosed by skeletal remains. Police, however, were certain that she was murdered because her arms were bound together with heavy twine. Evidently, the plastic in which all 3 bodies were bundled prevented the odor of decomposition from seeping into the house. Otherwise, some other tenant might have discovered the murders before Jerry Sand had during the termite inspection. Police believe the 3 were slain the day Mrs. Pearson failed to return to her store after her lunch break. This meant that the remains lay undetected under the house for 4.5 years. The FBI, at the request of Cedar City authorities, dropped their bad check alarm for Pearson and sent out a new one charging him with triple homicide. Sergeant Don Session and his detectives concluded that Pearson wiped out his family in a towering rage stemming from the tension of his financial disaster. Unanswered questions. Why were Paula's golf trophies smashed? Was it because she was so good at the game and her father wasn't? Such questions will probably have to remain unanswered until the authorities catch up with Pearson, and that may take some doing. There have been dozens of reported sightings of the fugitive since the murders came to light, but no leads. A Cedar City man and his son, who knew Pearson through the Mormon church, said that he was walking on the street during a vacation visit to Montreal, Canada, and they had seen a man who looked very much like Pearson. But before they could get a closer look, the man hastily took off and then disappeared. At the time of this article of the Daily News in New York on Sunday, October 6, 1974, was written, they concluded the article by stating that if you should spot someone that you believe that is Pearson, to call the authorities immediately. Do not try apprehending him yourself. He is still prone to fly off the handle. A stepdaughter by his Cedar City marriage said, quote, he had a pretty bad temper. A lot of times he would just leave the house when he was mad or upset and just go over to the hotel. He was always nervous and high-strung. It was like he always had something on his mind. End quote. However, it is undoubtedly he did have a lot on his mind. And that was my point, is that the remains of Pauline, Paula, and Marianne Pearson, my friends, he basically just left them under the house at Claremont Avenue to never be noted again. I also want to mention and point out a 1974 article, just a brief article that my criminologist friend Clark Williams sent to me from a 1974 Statement Journal News from Salem, Oregon. It reads, Canadian authorities came in contact with Pearson sometime in 1972 when he was arrested there on charges of embezzlement, which had been brought on by Utah authorities. The detectives say that Utah police did not want to extradite Pearson from Canada, so he was released there. The child was not with Pearson when he was arrested in Canada. All right, so this arrest was probably the thing that got him fingerprinted along with the mugshot and was able to be the information that the FBI wanted poster had produced. And I had always wondered how they got that, and how did that come to be, and now we know. It's one of those things is why, I mean, I would understand that probably Utah authorities didn't find that the embezzlement charge was worth bringing him back to Utah. Obviously, they did not know about what had happened. And I can just imagine that he was probably sitting on pins and needles thinking, that they were going to, that was it for him. He probably thought he was done because they hadn't yet found the bodies in 1972. But it, maybe in his mind, he thought, oh man, I'm busted and I'm caught, but we will never know. But that is where the mugshot and fingerprints came from. And that answers a lot of questions on my part.
That's fascinating.
And one of the things that's interesting is that the main witness in the case, Mary Winget, and the retired officer, Monty Macer, the burning question that they had when I had interviewed them was their concern for whatever happened to the boy, the baby, you know, the 11-month-old baby he took, Albert Ford Jr. And that has been something that they said recollected in their memories throughout the years of concern of whatever happened to him. So, Mark, as you know, my brother showed up at the house within probably a couple of days of the murder, and he was able to give me a really great interview. So what I'd like to do is play the interview and let him tell everybody what happened on that day in September.
So actually, Sonia, your brother's story is pretty impressive because he lived through something that could have gone sideways for him since he was there a few days after the murder happened. It's quite an amazing story to listen to.
It is. It's, and I didn't know any of this until I started telling him that I was covering this story and we were chatting about it. And he said to me, "Did I tell you what happened to me?" And I said, "No, what happened?" And I'll let him tell you all. I'm going to play this interview and then we'll come back and chat a bit about it. I'd like to welcome Mark Paz, who happens to be my brother, who can also give a personal perspective of what happened with the family and how he knew them. So welcome to the show, Mark. How are you doing?
Sonia, thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here. This is Mark Paz, and my involvement with the family really was just as a next-door neighbor, and I knew them, I think, about as early as 1968, approximately. They had two daughters, and I was closest to the one daughter, Mary Ann Pearson. They eventually moved away from the Woodhams' address in Santa Clara. They moved about a mile away to Claremont Avenue, and this was also in Santa Clara behind the Food Villa supermarket.
So you and I were both pretty small, and if you recall, Mary Ann was the one, as you said, that was closest to us, and she would come over and she'd help Mom with stuff, and then she would go with us to the beach and take us to the pool and things like that. What would be your most memory of her that you can let our listeners know about?
So there was a mutual like for the Beatles. At that time, the Beatles were at their, you know, on the rise, at their height. And Mary Ann, I remember, showed me a Beatles newspaper scrapbook that she had collected. And ultimately, she gave that to me as a gift. And I've, wow, I've kept it with me, and I still have it and kept it for many years.
Wow. So this is something that she had started, or maybe her mom or sister had started as a teenager with their love for the Beatles. Do you remember if they gave that to you when you were still living next door to us?
Mary Ann gave it to me when she was living next door to us on Woodhams.
I know you showed and shared with me that scrapbook, and it's pretty impressive about all of the information that they had gathered, well, of course, up to a certain point. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that when I was sharing with you, me doing the story and really wanting to tell the story about the family, you know, not as some of the news clippings that I had found online, and certainly not in a perspective of focusing on their demise and the horrible way that they had passed away, but wanted to give a perspective about how they were friends of ours and the relationship that we had. And you had shared with me an incident that you had stumbled into, or could have been fatal, but you shared with me an incident that occurred around 1969. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. At the time, in 1969, I was 10 years old. And still riding a bicycle, and was an active paper boy in the community. And so I stayed pretty busy, but I did get a lot of bike time at that age. And so I was all over the neighborhood. I did go to one afternoon to visit Mary Ann at the Claremont Avenue house. And I recall going up to the front door. The front door was open. The screen door was shut. And Mr. Pearson was in the back of the, as I recall, it was the family room, living room closest to the door, and then the kitchen directly behind that. He was standing in the kitchen and talking to me from there. And I walk up and I said, "Hey, I wanted to come by and see Mary Ann. Is she home?" And he told me, "Mary Ann's not here. Her sister and the mother, they all went on a trip back east. And they won't be back until the end of the summer," or something along that line. Then he asked, "Do you want to come in?" And I'm standing there at the front door, and I'm like, "No, I'm okay. I'll come back another day. And I turned around and left, and that was it.
So you saw Pearson right through the screen door, and he was in the kitchen, and he asked you if you wanted to come in.
Right, yes. He asked me. I didn't think anything of it for many years until you started to investigate, you know, this story, and it started to bring back some recollections, and you put together the timeline of when the mother and the daughters went missing, where Mr. Pearson had gone afterwards, how the authorities tracked him down, and so forth, and also what he had done at the time of the murders to them. And right. I started to think back, I'm like, wow, I could have been the fourth victim here and been stuffed under the house. And so that really just kind of started to surprise me, actually, just kind of putting it all together now.
And then you decided, no, I'm just going to go home. Did you ever tell Mom that you went over there?
I may have, you know, as a 10-year-old, you don't retain a lot of information. So I suppose I did.
Yeah. Cause I know that she told me never to ride over there cause it was too far, but knowing what we know now, I mean, because he actually only stayed at the house for probably less than a week, maybe 7 to 10 days. And that meant that when you went over there, and if he said that they had gone to Pennsylvania and they wouldn't be back for a while or whatever, then they were under the house when you went over there.
Right. They were under the house. I didn't know it then for sure, no. But thinking back, yes, yes, they were under the house.
And if you had gone in, you could have been that fourth victim just out of his irrational, crazy thought in his head.
I could have been possibly a loose end. Who knows?
Yeah.
But at the same time, if let's say I did go in and he assaulted me, Mom and Dad would never know for years later.
Right.
Because I probably didn't tell Mom or Dad that I was over there visiting. I just up and went over one day.
Right. And then do you recall in high school when, because I know I was in high school when they had learned that that Pauline, Paula, and Marianne were buried under the house. Do you remember hearing about all that?
I remember waking up one morning, and I think it was probably a Saturday because Mom and Dad were home. So, and the local police department detectives had started interviewing all the neighbors, and they were in the living room with Mom and Dad talking about what had happened. And so that's how I found out. And that's really it.
Yeah, because Mom basically told me, because, you know, I was really inquisitive. I still am. That's why I'm doing this story. But Mom basically told me to, you know, gave me some money, told me to go to 7-Eleven and kind of scram for a little while. But I remember when they called and said that they wanted to come over, and then they had come over. And I actually have spoken with those detectives. One of them is still alive, and the other detective had led up that investigation. I went and rode my bike around, and I came back and I snuck around the backyard and listened to what they were talking about from below the kitchen window. And they were talking about the Pearsons. And that afternoon or later that night, I remember asking Mom, what would happen with the family? And Mom was real upset. She didn't want to talk about it. I mean, she was like really shaken. It was pretty evident because, I mean, that was a big deal, you know, to find out that people that live next door to you had suddenly just disappeared one day and with no real notice. And then the father just doing what he did was, and the whole neighborhood, I recall, was really worried that the guy was at large in our neighborhood and was going to come and harm one of us. So it was pretty awful at the time. Just tell me what your thoughts are about how things kind of unfolded from what you remember.
Well, up until recently, we didn't know any of the facts. We didn't know the timeline. I always wondered what happened to Mr. Pearson. I had very little detail on his movements after he left Santa Clara.
Right.
And until recently, when we were able to put the timeline together. You know, the time, the date and year that they left the Woodhams address, the date of the murders, when the bodies were found, the date that he was arrested, and the trial date. So it put everything into perspective finally.
Yeah.
But up until like in the last year or two, I didn't know any of that. It was just a big question mark. So this really, having the discussion really helped to understand what truly occurred and what the timeline is. I always wondered what happened after they left the Woodhams or the Claremont address.
Right. Because there was one thing that I had read in one of the news articles. And, back then, they didn't go into massive detail when it came to the printed media. I mean, it was hit or miss. And one of the articles that I had located when I first started to investigate this years ago was that the mother, Pauline's mother, hadn't heard from her daughter and her granddaughters in a while and had reached out to the Santa Clara Police Department. And then fast forward to when they had discovered the bodies under the house. And apparently the authorities tried to reach out to her, but she had since passed away. And that really breaks my heart because, this poor lady just didn't know what happened to her family. She didn't know. They just disappeared. And that had to have been just awful for her. And I just, feel like she died of a broken heart. It just is so unsettling to even think that she encountered that kind of pain.
Right.
But well, thanks, Mark. I really appreciate you coming on and telling your side of the story, telling us and sharing us what you had encountered and how to remember Marianne, Pauline, and Paula when having just fond memories of them.
Well, thank you, Sony, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again. Take care.
All right. See you later.
So listening to that interview makes you think that Pearson was either worried tremendously about somebody at the door and wanted your brother to come in the house, or who knows what.
Yeah, who knows what? I mean, when he told me the story, I literally almost just fell out of my chair because I thought, oh my God. And when he had told me the story originally, I had asked him, did you tell mom? Because our mother was very overprotective. I said, did you tell mom that you went over there? And he said, no. And I said, holy mackerel, if you had gone in, it could have been years since we could have found you. Who knows what could have happened? He was just, it was evident he was a live wire at that point.
Absolutely, yeah. Not knowing what he may have done, for sure, because who knows? He may have thought your brother may have seen something or what. Nobody knows. So let me ask you, why was your brother going over there in the first place?
Because Marianne and Paula were our friends, and they had often asked us to go swimming at their house because this house had a pool. And he just got on his bike on a September afternoon and just rode his bike over there to say, hey. One of the things that my brother had also shared with me, and I actually have possession of it right now, is that before they had moved from Woodhams, they knew my brother was a fan of the Beatles, and they had this very comprehensive scrapbook of different articles and news clippings and things like that. And Marianne gave it to my brother. So this just also shows what a generous person that she was and how caring to give a 10-year-old boy this really incredible scrapbook. And in the scrapbook, you can see three different types of handwriting. You can tell which is the mother's handwriting, and then you can tell which might have been Paula's, and then you can tell which one would have been showing the penmanship of a girl who might have been somewhere between the ages of 12 and 14 to care enough about my brother to gift him this really cool thing. And so over all of these decades, and I had no idea about any of this, that he's had this thing for decades. And so he felt a kinship to them and just happened to ride the bike over there and happened to stop in. And as he had approached the house, he noticed that the screen door was closed, but the door was somewhat open. So he might have just, obviously thought that it was okay to go and check on the girls and see how they were.
And was able to leave without getting in trouble.
Was able to leave without getting in trouble and was able to leave with his life. And I'm not saying that something horrible would happen, but why on earth would this man invite a 10-year-old boy into the house? I mean, he could have been fearful that he could have seen or heard something.
And good thing is that your brother can talk about it today, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Be sure to tune in on our next episode where we will feature a recorded interview of a witness who testified and came face-to-face with Pearson within days of the murders. All this and a lot more on Investigated. Thanks, Sonia. See you next week.
Thanks, Mark. Looking forward to next week.
Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to follow Investigated on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, visit investigatedpod.com to visit our website to learn more about your hosts, Sonia Paz and Mark Kapschick. Follow us on social media and connect with us. Investigated is written, edited, and hosted by me, Sonia Paz, with story advisement and input from Mark Kapschick, and many thanks to the research of criminologist Clark Williams and also to Allison Betts Goldman for her contributions to this story.